Okay, so were there any questions from yesterday? We talked about the axion solution to the strong CP problem and then talked about a few ways that we could look for axions astrophysically and in the lab.
So I watched the lecture online, but I can't remember. There is no constraint on the axion mass from the CP point of view, right? It's more like the value of F.
That's correct. Yeah. So solving the strong CP problem gives you a relationship between M and F because the potential goes like lambda QCD over F squared. So you get a yeah. So yeah. Now I just wanted to mention one last lab test, which is something that's in development. This was proposed by a few years ago by some folks at Stanford, and it actually uses the motivation of the fact that the axion solves the problem of CP violation to try and look for it. And the idea is that we have some theta parameter plus A over FA, and there might be some order one coefficient here, trace of GG tilde. And we saw that in the case of just the theta, this led to an electric dipole moment for the neutron that was something like 10 to the minus 16 theta e centimeters. Okay? So the whole point of the strong CP problem is that we measure this to be very small, less than about 10 to the minus 26. And so we want the theta, which in the axion case is the linear combination of these things, to be zero. But we know that the axion field is actually, it's in some potential and it's oscillating back and forth. It was oscillating back and forth in the very early universe, or it started oscillating around the QCD scale, but it's completely out of equilibrium. There's nothing that's stopping it from oscillating today. So it's just continued to redshift, and that's what, if we believe axion dark matter is, it's just the oscillations of this field. So this suggests that we should have some oscillating electric dipole moment, which goes like, value of A today over F axion cos MAT e centimeters times 10 to the minus 16. Okay? Just from saying, okay, well, if I have theta here, I can have A over FA here, and then I put in, the this numerically works out to be something like 10 to the minus 35 cos MAT e centimeters. So this is very, very small. The current limits are about 10 to the minus 26 or so. But the key thing is that it's oscillating. And that's a really weird thing because what's basically happening is that you have neutrons that are sitting in this background field of axions. The axions are oscillating. And the neutrons acquire some little electric dipole moment that is in phase with the axion oscillation. Now, we know that from the Standard Model perspective, if a particle has a property, it should definitely not be changing in time. So if we can observe some time-varying property of some particle, for instance, an electric dipole moment, then this is a very clear signature that there's some new physics going on, that there's some background field that's driving the dynamics of this. Okay. So basically, there are proposals to look for very tiny oscillating electric dipole moments. And it's usually easier to look for an oscillating thing rather than a constant thing, because if you're looking for a constant electric dipole moment, you need to make sure that you're taking into account all of your stray fields and there aren't accidental things that leak in. But it's much easier in a noisy environment to look for a very regular variation. So there are some proposals that could get to this sensitivity. And of course, this depends on what the frequency is, but this could probe some of the parts of the dark matter parameter space that currently you can't see. So this is part of the interesting thing about if dark matter is some classical field dynamics, is that there are some weird classical field effects that are associated with it. You don't have to look for particle scattering. You can look for the fact that properties of Standard Model particles are affected by this changing background. Okay, so for the last lecture today, I wanted to talk about some open questions in dark matter. And as you can guess by now, there are a lot of open questions. We've all the things that we've talked about have at the end of the day been speculative because we haven't actually addressed them, or sorry, we haven't actually seen them experimentally. But mostly what we've done is we've sort of assumed conventional dark matter, which means that it's cold, collisionless, etc. And then we propose models for dark matter and try to test them. But we can ask whether some of these assumptions that we made were originally valid in the first place, or that the things that were driving the model building, maybe those aren't even properties that we should be expecting from dark matter. Okay? So what I'll talk about are some hints that may or may not be evidence for interesting dynamics in the dark sector, and which are driving a lot of interesting research going on in dark matter today. And so we'll talk about two hints for interesting dark matter physics. The first one are going to be small-scale structure anomalies. And what I mean by this is that where we have successfully seen dark matter and where it seems to match our expectation from cold collisionless dark matter is everything ranging from the CMB, so very cosmological scales, down to about galactic size scales. But once we start looking down at smaller scales, we start to see disagreements between the predictions of the cold dark matter model and what we see astrophysically. And so maybe this is hinting that the cold dark matter paradigm sort of breaks down and that there's something interesting going on that messes around with structure formation on small scales. The second one is the dark matter baryon coincidence. And this, stated plainly, is just the fact that we see about the same amount of dark matter in the universe as we do of baryons. Okay? They differ in abundance by about a factor of 5. So in all of the mechanisms that we've been studying so far, these things have absolutely nothing to do with one another. And so it's a weird puzzle that everything kind of, we happen to be living in an era where there's comparable amounts of both. Okay? This is related to something called the cosmic coincidence problem, where you also have, you know, dark energy is also the same order of magnitude as the other things, which is sort of a weird thing. But this might be suggesting that there are other connections between dark matter and visible matter that we haven't looked at so far. Tipra. Yeah, so dark matter is about 27% and baryons are about 5%. But they could be have been 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times apart. You know, there's no reason why they are the same order of magnitude in the conventional picture. Okay. So neither of these things should be taken as a definitive breakdown of what sort of dark matter things we've looked at so far, but in the absence of seeing evidence in any of the other things that we've been looking for, maybe this will kind of point in new directions that we can go. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, what do you mean?
Like, I mean, you know, the experiments that we made, that we have, that distinguishes, that, you know, that tells us that the universe has 70% dark energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If one of the components was like 1,000 times smaller than the other,
oh, probably not. Well, but that's presupposing that there has to be dark matter and not dark matter, right? So, for instance, so it's not obvious that you need, for instance, to have dark matter in order to say, evolve like observers or something if you want to make anthropic type arguments. Okay, so for instance, in the standard model, you have neutrino dark matter. It's hot, and so it doesn't form structure in the same way that dark matter forms structure in our universe. But that's more a question of like matching with observation. So that's certainly a direction you can go in, and you know, people make arguments. So for instance, some arguments for why dark energy is comparable, people say, well, you can't have dark energy be too big, but you know, you need a certain amount of time for life to evolve, and usually by that time the vacuum energy dominates or something like that. So you know, people can use anthropic arguments, but I haven't heard any convincing ones for the dark matter one. And at the end of the day, as with everything, it could just be a coincidence. You know, the strong CP problem could just be a coincidence. They could all just be coincidences. So you know, these aren't sure things regarding you know, what we should be expecting for dark matter. Okay, so let's start by seeing what's going on with small-scale structure. The other thing I want to point out is that these are not new observations. Okay, so these things have now been kicking around for the last 20 to 30 years. Okay, so the small-scale structure anomalies. What we see is a breakdown of predictions of the cold dark matter model on subgalactic scales, or sort of twiddle galactic scales and below. So the first one we're going to talk about is something called the missing satellites problem. And this was first discussed in 98 or thereabouts. And when you look at how structure forms, because dark matter has no interactions and it's assumed to be cold, what happens is that the little perturbations that occurred, say, after inflation, gravity slowly pulls things in, and so the denser perturbations become more dense, and the lesser perturbations become a little bit less dense. And so you end up with what are essentially galaxies. So you have, for instance, the Milky Way. But not everything falls directly into the Milky Way, because there are perturbations at all scales, essentially. And so you end up with a whole bunch of satellite galaxies, which are sort of drawn into the orbit of the Milky Way. So there are a whole bunch of these. So the sort of brightest ones that are close to us are called the Magellanic Clouds, but there are a whole bunch of other ones. And as with everything to do with dark matter structure formation, we have to rely on n-body simulations. So basically simulations where we take a whole bunch of clumps of matter and then we let it gravitate and we see how it evolves under the force of gravity. And we can parameterize the satellites according to this parameter Vmax. And Vmax, if you remember that there were these rotational curves where we have R, V of R, and they kind of look like this. Vmax, well, I guess this is Vmax here. This is R of Vmax. That's the maximum velocity at which these galaxies are rotating. And so what we can do is we can say, you know, just count how many galaxies have larger than the indicated Vmax. Okay, so the scale ranges from something like 0, 25 to 60, 1, 10, 100. And the simulations under various assumptions all kind of give us things that look like this. So, you know, there are a bunch of lines here from different simulation parameters. And what we see are parameters that look like this. Okay. So there seem to be about an order of magnitude fewer satellite galaxies than are predicted by simulation. And these are the same simulations that successfully predict sort of galactic and galaxy cluster and all larger structure. Okay, so this is called the missing satellite problems, because you know, the suggestion is that, at least according to our simulations, there should be many more. And of course, as I pointed out, this has been going on since 98. Improvements in these simulations have been dramatic since that time. So they've gone to higher resolution and so on. And this problem has not been fixed from the perspective of pure cold dark matter. So this suggests that this isn't just a problem with numerics, but it's either a problem with the model that we're putting into the simulation, or that dark matter is doing something funny. Now, in the past 5 years, there has been a proposed solution, and namely that high energy astrophysical processes can strip sort of gas out of small proto galaxies. So what this solution says is that in the very early universe before stars were forming, there's all this gas that was slowly infalling and would eventually form stars. And so if we have a sufficiently small galaxy, then maybe very energetic emissions of cosmic rays from various processes can just strip off the visible stuff. And so we actually do have these satellite galaxies from the perspective of dark matter, but they just don't accumulate stars. And so we don't see them. So basically what this means is that there's some systematic loss here associated with some high energy astrophysics in the early universe, which is plausible. And so people said, okay, well, maybe the missing satellite problem isn't really a real problem. But it turns out that this leads to a new problem, which is called the too big to fail problem. You can guess that this is, after 2008 that this title was created. This was in 2011. And what this is saying is that we have these satellites on all kinds of different scales, going from very small to very big. So these astrophysical processes that strip gas off tend to make the bigger ones look smaller. But eventually, you're going to hit a very big satellite, which you just can't strip enough gas off of, and you're going to end up with a fairly luminous galaxy. Okay. So for big satellites, the gas stripping mechanism doesn't work. And so where this title comes from, it's a little bit contrived, but these satellites are too big to fail to form luminous galaxies. Okay. And so what they do is they take simulations and identify what are the ones that are too big to fail to form satellites. And then they try to match them with the observed the observed Milky Way satellites. Okay, so what they see. So here's a plot of, say, the log of the luminosity against Vmax. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. So when they do their simulations, which I'll keep doing in white chalk, they find that they can match the observed luminosity, but that the Vmax is very different. So, from the simulation, this is sort of an idealized picture, but there are some 9 or 10 massive bright satellites. And so these are matched to subhalos in the simulation. And the actual observed one looked kind of like this. Okay. So basically, it tells us that we can kind of concoct some story where, the very heaviest subhalos host some of the Milky Way satellites. But if we use the sort of, the size of the subhalo to estimate what the rotational velocity of these galaxies are, it's off by a factor of 3 or to 5. So once again, this is telling us that the simulations are providing two large subhalos that we just don't see. And the gas stripping mechanism doesn't work. To explain this, there still seems to be some systematic bias where the Milky Way subhalos are just not big enough to match the ones coming from N-body simulations. So this is basically telling us that the missing satellite problem sort of comes in two pieces. You can either solve the lack of low Vmax galaxies, but it's at the expense of messing up your high Vmax galaxies. Okay. Are there any questions about these two? Yes, Tubra. Yeah, so I think things associated with reionization, you have these like early quasar formation things which eject high energy cosmic rays. I think that's the idea. Yeah. But I'm not an astrophysicist, so I don't know that much about it. It's plausible that, you know, very early things form that emit high energy cosmic rays that kind of, if you don't have much gas to begin with, can just knock it out. And there's some critical density at which you just don't form stars if it's too low. Okay, so there's actually a third thing, which is called the cusp core problem. And this, I forgot to write down a date, but this is also dates from the 90s. And the idea behind the cusp core problem is that we once again do N-body simulations. And this gives us a dark matter density profile. Okay, so we talked, for instance, about this NFW, the Navarro-Frank-White profile, which in its canonical form looks like rho of r is rho naught r sub s over r, 1 plus r over r sub s to the minus 2, where r sub s is something like 20 kiloparsecs, and us, we're something like 8 kiloparsecs. So this is in a Milky Way type galaxy. Of course, if you have a dwarf or something, the scales are going to be completely different. So what this tells us is that the dark matter density has a cusp, namely that the density goes like 1 over r as you goes towards the center. And this makes sense because dark matter is fairly cold and there's a big mass of stuff that's in the center. And so it just gets pulled into the center. And you know, that seems to make a lot of sense. So what we can do is we can plot, we say rho goes like r to the alpha, and we plot that as a function of the radius. Okay, and so once again, we will plot what the simulations show. We sort of have something that looks like this. That as we go out to larger radii, you start having, say, a turnover to this r to the minus 3 behavior. And none of the individual measurements are very good, but if I plot, say, a few hundred characteristic density profiles that I can estimate from rotation curves, they kind of lie like here. So this is both from dwarfs, which are dark matter dominated, and from regular, you know, disk galaxies like the Milky Way. Of course, we don't have a very good probe of our own galaxy, but you know, such is life. So what seems to be happening is that instead of having a dark matter density that goes like this, there's some cutoff scale at which the dark matter kind of flattens out. So we call this a core. Call this a cusp. And so once again, we're seeing that once we go into very small scales, something seems to be wrong. Okay, so there are some possible resolutions to these puzzles. Okay. The first and biggest one, and the one that people are expending a lot of energy to address, is that N-body simulations conventionally, and this means historically and including some today, don't include baryons. Which from a cosmological perspective makes a lot of sense, because baryons are some very small perturbation around dark matter. But as soon as you're talking about going into the inner few kiloparsecs of a galaxy or satellites of the Milky Way, things like this, it seems like a very poor approximation. And indeed, there are some proposals for how baryons can affect these things, and there are claims that including baryons can fix them. So for instance, supernovae lead to ejection of baryonic matter, and then this pulls dark matter out. Right, so you have some very high concentration of baryons, and then in the early universe you had a ton of supernovae, and then this ejected matter, and maybe that sort of dragged the dark matter along with it. And maybe this, you know, can be tied in with some of these astrophysical processes that kind of suppress the formation of small-scale structure. Okay. There are some issues that people have with this. One of it is, you know, does it work in dark matter-dominated galaxies like dwarfs? Because one would expect that, okay, if it's true that baryons dominate the energy density, then I can understand that baryons have an effect. But if baryons are never dominating the dynamics of the galaxy, it seems a little bit hard to see how this is resolved. The other, so there's sort of two camps at the moment. One says cold dark matter is correct. When we add in baryons, everything is fixed. There's another camp that says, well, you have some parameter in your model, and when you just change that parameter without even necessarily thinking about how realistic it is, okay, maybe you can resolve some of these things, but that's basically just tuning your simulation to give you the right answer. It could be covering up a lot of things. And so this is a very active topic of controversy. The people who believe in cold dark matter believe very strongly that this is the answer, and you can see why that's probably right, that the simplest answer is probably correct, and we're doing some crude simulations, so maybe it's just a problem with the simulations, but there are other people that don't believe that this is true. The other possibility is astrophysics. Then maybe there are some astrophysical processes that we have not been putting into our simulations or that are having some effect that we haven't anticipated. So that sort of turned out to be the resolution to the missing satellite problem. It then led to this new problem, but maybe there's something else that we're just missing. And then the third, which is most exciting for people who don't believe in the conventional cold dark matter scenario, is that there's some new dark matter physics. And that because all of these hints are sort of pointing at a particular distance scale, that this is telling us something about what dark matter is doing on these scales, that it's an actual physical effect. And there are, roughly speaking, two proposals for how dark matter can influence this. The first is self-interacting dark matter. And the idea is that the formation of things like cusps and very small-scale structure relies on the fact that we have some very cold population of dark matter that sort of just sinks into the middle. And then it's surrounded by some sort of haze of less cold. So that there's some, you know, very low-momentum dark matter particles that just fall straight in, and then there's some higher-momentum ones, because, of course, we know that on average, V is like 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3. And so, you know, there's obviously some Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution of velocities, and so this explains why you end up with cusps and you end up with the formation of structure. But if we allow, you know, chi to scatter off itself, then I can take a sort of warmer chi and a colder chi, and I can make them sort of less warm and less cold as a result of elastic collisions. So what this means is that as things are falling in this cold state, you have other stuff that can come and kind of collide with it and give it some momentum. And what this tends to do is just produce a more uniform, you know, more homogeneous dark matter halo. And so this suppresses structure on small scales. So maybe these things that are missing are there because they're actually, we're seeing it because they're actually missing, and this is telling us indirectly about something of the dynamics of what's going on in the dark matter sector. So to give you a sense of the kinds of scattering cross-sections you need, they're usually listed in cross-section per mass. This is between 0.1 and 10 centimeters squared per gram. And this is actually huge. This is about a QCD scale sigma, if you convert it to units that we're used to working with. It's like 10 to the minus 22 centimeters squared per second, cubed per second, or something like this. Okay, so in order to resolve these problems, dark matter has to be actually quite strongly interacting. Now, we talked in the first lecture about how there's this bullet cluster where you have two colliding galaxy clusters, and we see that the dark matter halos pass through one another. And so you can put constraints on the cross-section from that, and it turns out that they're, depending on your assumptions, you know, comparable. So these two things are in a little bit of a tension, that the kinds of rates that you need to wipe out small-scale structure are comparable to or bigger than the kinds of rates that you need that are excluded by the bullet cluster. So this is excluded. But as you showed in your tutorial last Friday, I guess it was, where you did this, you know, worked on the Sommerfeld enhancement, for instance, you can see that you can have cross-sections that are very different at different velocities. And so, for instance, if you have a WIMP, you know, order 100 GeV, and then you have some mediator, it's about an MeV, then you exactly get these kinds of Sommerfeld enhancements, and there can even be resonances associated with them. So you got a highly velocity-dependent cross-section. And so this is a potential way of reconciling these things, where on smaller scales, dwarfs and things like this, there's not that much gravity, and so the velocity is slower, and so you can get these big enhancements in the scattering cross-section. Whereas on the cluster, galaxy cluster scale, things are much more energetic, and you don't have as much of an enhancement in the cross-section. So this is sort of an ongoing thing that people are looking at. You know, can we consistently get resolutions to these problems and still, you know, not be ruled out by various other constraints on self-interacting dark matter? Okay. So are there any questions about this? Yes. Sorry, who is it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It leads to a homogeneous dark matter halo if the inelasticity is sufficiently small that you have some of the excited state. So the question there is, you know, if cosmologically you only have the ground state and you don't have enough energy to produce the excited state, then it won't effectively doesn't scatter because it decouples. Yeah, you're thinking of it in terms of like an inelastic model, right? Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's a good question. So this is assuming that you actually have some interactions involving things that are here. But, you know, if you have some process that upscatters and then you have, you know, a collision, then that could work. Good. Okay. Any other questions about this? Yes. Typically not, no. So kiloparsec is sort of the smallest that that's usually can go. Would we expect So people talk about trying to do this, but I think the effect is usually quite small, particularly because we are in the inner 20 kiloparsecs, so we're definitely in the baryon-dominated part of the galaxy, and so locally it's a very, very small effect. But people do talk about trying to observe the local dark matter halo by, for instance, you know, looking in towards the galactic center, looking out in the first, you know, kiloparsec and seeing whether you can look for differences in the dynamics. So that's definitely something that people will try to do. And of course, that's interesting from the perspective of dark matter direct detection, because then you could actually have some probe of what dark matter is right here. So, the other problem, though, with that is that because dark matter does sometimes form streams and, you know, funny things when you look at the velocity distribution, I think observing something locally wouldn't tell you something about sort of macroscopic properties of dark matter interactions or whatever, because it could always just be some quirk of our local thing. So, you know, that's why people try to count lots of different galaxies with lots of different shapes and things to try to look for trends associated with that. Okay, so the second thing is warm dark matter. And this is basically the observation that it doesn't clump as easily. Because the gravitational pull has to overcome the kinetic energy. And so you also end up just, instead of having sort of colder and less cold things and they become more homogeneous, you just end up with a more homogeneous, less structured halo. And so the current limits, assuming that it's thermal, let me say that in order to solve this problem, you need to have masses that are the KeV scale, so much lighter than the kinds of WIMPs that we were talking about. Now, there are other probes of structure. So there's namely something called the Lyman alpha forest. Have any of you heard of the Lyman alpha forest? No. Okay, so the Lyman alpha forest is the Lyman alpha transition, so it's the first transition in hydrogen. This is the most common sort of light that we see in the universe. And as you go to farther distances, you see things are more redshifted. So instead of seeing a spectral line, you see sort of a whole forest of spectral lines. And it was sort of proposed that all of these things actually come from the same transition, but you're probing things at different redshifts, essentially. And then you can look for things like structure. Is there clumping of matter at a certain redshift in a certain direction? Things like this. And this seems to suggest, so first of all, they do see structure. And this suggests that the actual constraint is bigger than about a few keV. So this is, yet again, some tension. So we see that there's a suppression of structure formation, for instance, in this missing satellites problem or cusp core. But when we look into the early universe, it seems like structure is forming on those scales. Okay, so there's some conflict there. And the problem with this is that it's very subject to your understanding of what's going on with baryons. So this is a bound, but it sort of has an asterisk next to it, where you have to be careful with, you know, there are assumptions that go into the driving this bound. It's not a very robust bound. So people still are thinking, okay, is there a way to make these things compatible and be consistent with Lyman alpha? Now, this isn't a problem with the self-interacting dark matter, because in the self-interacting dark matter, you do form the structure, but then it gets later wiped out by collisions. Okay, so that's not so much of a constraint. So these are sort of the two most interesting ideas related to solving the small-scale structure anomalies. Now, how much you want to believe this is sort of up to you. Some people find this very convincing. Other people say, well, it's very hard to go from a cosmological simulation down to simulating subgalactic scales. And so maybe you're just pushing your simulations in a way that they weren't intended to do. That's certainly what the people who believe including baryons is the resolution to, but it remains to be seen what the best way of doing this, what the correct resolution to these problems are. The hope is that if you have self-interacting dark matter, for instance, that you start seeing other phenomena. So for instance, if you have self-interacting dark matter, you can have dark radiation, you can have dark recombination, dark acoustic oscillations, dark nucleosynthesis, dark atoms, dark, you know, all of this kind of thing, right? So I mean, basically, if you have self-interacting dark matter sector looks a lot like our sector, where you have some strong interactions. And so hopefully, we won't just have to rely on these kinds of anomalies if that's the correct answer, but that we'll actually maybe see some evidence for these other features that come along with dark interactions. Okay, are there any questions about the whole small-scale structure picture? Okay. Whoops. So the second thing, which I'll talk about more briefly, is the dark matter baryon coincidence. And this is not a conflict between, say, a simulation and an observation, but this is just sort of commenting on how weird the current universe seems to look, where we have 5% baryons and 27% dark matter. And of course, you know, people are very excited by the fact that there's dark matter, but once you accept that there's dark matter, there's no reason why these things should even fit on the same pie chart, basically. And so we can ask, how is the dark matter abundance established? And that's been a major theme of the course. And so hopefully by now you recognize a few of these things. We have WIMP miracle, the thermal freeze out is some way that you can have the abundance. Or we can have freeze-in production of dark matter, or have misalignment production of dark matter. And the list goes on. Okay, so there are lots of possible production mechanisms. But for baryons, we know what sets the abundance of baryons. We don't know what caused this to happen, but we know that there's the number of baryons exceeded the number of antibaryons in the early universe. And so the yield of baryons at infinity is basically equal to YB minus YB bar at early times. So even though in the early universe there were many more baryons and antibaryons around, there was some tiny excess of baryons over antibaryons, and that completely explains everything that we see now. And this, of course, comes from just direct observation that we see protons and not antiprotons. Okay. And you showed in one of your tutorials that if you don't have this asymmetry, there's this so-called annihilation catastrophe, where all of the baryons annihilate away and you're just left with nothing. Okay, so the heart of the dark matter baryon coincidence is that there doesn't seem to be any connection between these mechanisms. So why are the numbers within an order one factor of one another when, you know, there could be exponential factors that pop up in various abundances? And so, you know, why is this true? And so a possible resolution to this question is something called asymmetric dark matter. And this is just the statement that, well, if we understand that the baryon abundance is because we have some number of baryons and some smaller number of antibaryons, then maybe we also have some amount of dark matter and some smaller amount of anti-dark matter. And then in the early universe, you have chi-chi bar annihilating to FF bar, and this stops when the number of chi bar goes to zero, essentially. And we're left with just some remnant chi. This is called asymmetric because there's an asymmetry between dark matter and dark antimatter. And there can be a connection between these sectors. So for instance, imagine that we have some interaction and it goes something like chi cubed UDD plus the Hermitian conjugate. So this has a baryon number of one, right? This is just a neutron, essentially. And this has some dark matter charge. And so it's possible that there's actually some shared baryon numbered minus dark matter number charge. So what this means is that when this operator was active, you have processes that take UDD to chi bar, chi bar, chi bar, and you have processes that take U bar, D bar, D bar, goes to chi, chi, chi. This is proportional to the number of baryons. This is proportional to the number of antibaryons. And we know that these are not equal. So what we get is that the difference between these rates is not zero. So in this case, I have a net production of anti-dark matter relative to dark matter that's sourced by the baryon asymmetry. And what this tends to do is it tends to make the NB minus NB bar comparable to N dark matter bar minus N dark matter. Okay? Because as soon as the number density of the difference between N chi bar and N chi is the same as the difference between NB and NB bar, then the inverse processes start turning on and you get a net equilibrium effect. So if we accept that this mechanism is the correct one for giving us dark matter, we can now estimate the dark matter properties because we know that rho baryons is mass of baryons times N delta baryon, and rho chi is M chi N delta chi. And so we see that rho chi is 5 rho baryons. And so N chi is just N baryons N delta chi over N delta baryon. And this is about 1, say, in this very simple picture. So this immediately gives us M chi is about 5 GeV. This is sort of the natural prediction for the dark matter mass in this model. And there was sort of a resurgence of interest in asymmetric dark matter a few years ago because several direct detection experiments were seeing nuclear recoils consist or things consistent with nuclear recoils that would be consistent with dark matter of a mass of, say, 5 to 7, 5 to 10 GeV. So people were saying, okay, well, if you're in that mass range, maybe the Wimp miracle, you know, thermal freeze-out can work, but it's constrained by various things and you know, you don't have this nice order one coupling anymore. So maybe you really have asymmetric dark matter. Now, today, most of these anomalies are gone, so that motivation for it is gone. But there's still some properties of asymmetric dark matter that regular WIMPs don't have. So basically, there's no indirect detection. The reason being that just like there are no antiprotons today, there are no anti-dark matter particles today. And so there's nothing for the dark matter in the halo to annihilate with. And so this means that all of the constraints from things like CMB or Fermi are all gone. And so asymmetric dark matter is one of the few ways that you can consistently have very light dark matter, because we showed in the indirect detection lecture last week that things below between 10 and 100 GeV are ruled out from a thermal relic. So this is just saying, okay, well, instead of having a thermal relic, if it's asymmetric, I just don't get any late annihilation. Okay. It also means that you can have larger sigma V than in freeze out. Namely that in the freeze-out scenario, the number density went like 1 over sigma v. Whereas in the asymmetric case, this is fixed by this y chi minus y chi bar, which is independent of sigma v. So you need to have a large enough sigma v so that you annihilate away all of the anti-dark matter, but you can have an extremely large, potentially, annihilation cross-section. And just like how baryons have a very large annihilation cross-section, and yet we still have baryons today, similarly, we can still have dark matter today. So the very optimistic people were like, when we discover dark matter at the LHC, and we find that it has a very large production cross-section, much larger than you'd expect from thermal, then asymmetric dark matter is the right explanation because it's consistent with having a very large annihilation cross-section. Now, that hasn't happened, but we can always hope that something like that will happen. Okay. Now, you can ask whether we've actually resolved the dark matter baryon coincidence, because I basically used the dark matter baryon coincidence to tell me what the dark matter mass is. So some people find it compelling. Other people have just said you've exchanged one free parameter for another free parameter, and that if I made the dark matter mass 100 GeV, I would end up with 100 times the baryonic dark matter. So some people still try to think about, are there ways of explaining why the mass is like this? Or conversely, can we use dark matter dynamics to generate a baryon asymmetry, and therefore tie their scales in together as well? So there are lots of kind of interesting possibilities. And the most promising one of these is that why people think about this is that you expect to see new stuff around the weak scale. You expect new light states, or you expect to be generating your baryon asymmetry around the weak scale, so it gives us some hope of observing cosmological stuff at the experiments that we've built to look for the Higgs, for instance. Okay, so are there questions about the dark matter baryon coincidence? No? Okay, so let's summarize what we've looked at so far. So in the very first lecture, I wrote down the dark matter is, it's some new particle. Okay, that you probably still believe. I said that it's neutral. So maybe it's neutral. Maybe it has some small standard model charges. Okay. I said that it's collisionless. It doesn't interact with itself. Well, maybe it's collisionless. We don't actually know. We've seen that there's actually a lot of room here for not only accommodating dark matter with interactions, but using it to explain various things. Okay. Is dark matter stable? Maybe. We don't actually know, okay? We've seen models where dark matter is not stable, but we know that it has to be stable on cosmological scales, but they're very interesting models that don't. I also said the dark matter has to be cold, which maybe it's cold and maybe it's not cold. So what this should tell you is that for everything that we've come to understand about dark matter, it seems that every time we learn something new about dark matter, it kind of confuses us even more, okay? That there are various things that are conflicting, and the confidence in some of these measurements is growing with time. And so the hope that maybe the small-scale structure anomalies or whatever will just improve with the next iteration are gone. Okay. Similarly, the hope with every new direct detection experiment that's built is, okay, it's going to discover dark matter. We're now at cross-sections that are 10 orders of magnitude smaller than the original motivated ones, and we still are 8 cross orders of magnitude, but still a lot of orders of magnitude. We still haven't seen anything. So is building another one the right thing to do, or should we be trying to pursue a different direction? And so it seems that what we really need are sort of new ideas. And all of these things have come out of people sitting carefully and questioning the assumptions that have been made about what dark matter is doing. So, for instance, new ideas for theory, like, are we missing something really big? So, for instance, is there some paradigm for either dark matter production, dark matter detection? Are we looking in all of the wrong places? And I would say that the lack of success of the conventional dark matter detection stories is really driving people to seriously think about the way that they've talked about dark matter discovery. And you see it in the media where they say, well, dark matter might be excluded at the next detection experiment or something. And so people are saying, well, is that really true? We have this huge range of possibilities. maybe there's a new natural solution that's not the WIMP miracle and that's not the misalignment mechanism, but it's something else that we just haven't thought of yet. Okay. Are there connections that we're missing with other aspects of standard model physics? So the standard model has a lot of very non-trivial things. There's, you know, this naturalness problem. There's the question of flavor. You know, why do the quarks have the masses they do and the structures they do? Maybe there's some interesting things to do there. There's also room for new ideas for experiments. Namely that, you know, are there clear signals that we haven't thought of? And so there's a lot of room for interesting and innovative contributions from people in all kinds of areas. And, you know, this suggests that there's a very exciting time for particle physics, because when we look at, for instance, particle physics connections with dark matter, as we've done here, but you can also do it with baryogenesis or other things, you know, there's, for lack of a better word, conventional particle physics, like sitting down and computing Feynman diagrams, if that's the kind of thing that you're into. But there's also, you know, we need to know a lot about cosmology, about the evolution of the universe through all of its epochs in order to understand how these particle physics processes come into play. We need to know a lot about astrophysics, both in order to understand what the backgrounds for dark matter searches are and to think of new ways of looking for dark matter. Okay. So for instance, it was recently discovered that, okay, if you have asymmetric dark matter that doesn't annihilate, if it clumps together in, say, a star, it doesn't annihilate, it just keeps clumping, and eventually it can form a black hole. Okay, and so that's something that people hadn't really thought of, and so now suddenly they're saying, okay, well, what kind of limits can we put on asymmetric dark matter from the fact that neutron stars haven't turned all into black holes? Right? So you need to have a good understanding of astrophysics. Nuclear physics. You know, we needed this in order to understand the properties of dark matter interacting with nuclei. Atomic and optical physics. So for instance, in the kinds of experiments where you look for electric dipole moments or things like this, what you're trying to do is do precision measurements. And so you need to have good control over fields. You need to have good control over atoms and molecules. And so this has a lot of interface with like quantum gases and things like this. There are, of course, the very important formal developments. And we've only had a very small taste of that here. But there's, you know, we saw that non-perturbative dynamics can have a very important impact on the phenomenology of particle physics theories. And so we want to be able to better understand these things, to calculate them, to make sure maybe we're not missing something in a non-perturbative sector that we're not paying attention to. And of course, we live in sort of an amazing era where there's a ton of data. There's the LHC that's turning back on. We have, you know, many experiments that are doing direct detection, indirect detection. We have, it's just pretty incredible, actually, the amount of data that's coming in. And so the best question here is, you know, what's the best way to use this data to improve our understanding of the universe? So the hope is that sort of the confluence of all of these things will give us a better understanding of dark matter. And so we just have to wait and see. Hopefully we'll discover it sometime soon. So. Any questions about this or anything, really? Okay, well, thank you so much for participating. It's been a real pleasure. And hopefully, you know, best of luck with everything that you're doing. And I hope to, you know, see good things from all of you sometime soon.